Hello, this is UCL Uncovering Politics, and this week we're reflecting on the COP26 climate conference. Was the meeting in Glasgow a success, or did it fall short of expectations? Hello, my name is Jennifer Hudson, and welcome to UCL Uncovering Politics, the podcast of the School of Public Policy and Department of Political Science at UCL. Today, we're taking a retrospective look at the outcomes of the COP26 conference that was held in Glasgow earlier this month. COP, or Conference of the Parties, is the annual UN climate change conference. A key aim of the conference was to keep 1.5 alive, but was enough progress made on cutting emissions to reach this goal? And have rich countries stepped up to the plate by agreeing to pay for loss and damage in poorer countries? Are we making progress fast enough? I'm delighted to say that we have three leading experts on these matters here, and they join me now. Jared Finnegan is lecturer in public policy, and before joining UCL, he was a postdoctoral fellow at UC Berkeley and Princeton University. His research investigates how governments, voters, and business understand and address long-term societal challenges, particularly around climate change. Fergus Green is lecturer in political theory and public policy. His research is on the normative analysis of public policy and on processes of political change, especially concerning climate change and decarbonization. And Lisa Van Halle is professor of political science and the principal investigator of the ERC-funded Climate Change Loss and Damage Project. Jared, Fergus, and Lisa, welcome to UCL Uncovering Politics. Let me begin by asking each of you your top takeaway, your key insight from the conference in Glasgow. What surprised you or shocked you, made you concerned or made you hopeful? Jared, let me come to you first.
So one thing that I thought was particularly interesting, I'm not sure if I'm hopeful about this yet or not, but the quantity of net zero pledges that were brought forward. And so even 5 years ago, when the Paris Agreement was first negotiated, net zero was still relatively a new concept or a concept that many countries weren't fully committed to or signed up to or even talking about. And so the fact that so many countries brought forward these sorts of pledges, I think, is a real interesting change, at least in the discourse of international climate politics. Whether it's these pledges are credible, whether countries will actually hit them is a separate question. But at least this new idea of what a country could achieve by mid-century or beyond in some cases, I think is interesting.
Fantastic. Fergus, what did you observe? What did you take away from COP?
Yeah, thanks, Jennifer. So one thing that surprised me were the references to fossil fuels in the final decision text. The Glasgow Pact, as it's called, quote, calls upon parties to accelerate efforts towards the phase down of unabated coal power and phase out of inefficient fossil fuel subsidies, end quote. Now, that may not sound like much, and in the grand scheme of things, it isn't. Yet it is the first time in three decades of climate change negotiations that any of the formal decision texts or any of the treaties even have mentioned fossil fuels explicitly. And we can perhaps discuss a bit later why that is. But the fact that they were mentioned at all was something that surprised a lot of people, including myself.
That was certainly part of the discussion and in the last closing days, the debate around fossil fuel. And you've mentioned that kind of phasing down, which we will come back to because it was one of the kind of key debates around COP. So I'll be interested to hear more of your thoughts on that later. Lisa, you know, you were at COP and we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. What did you take away from it?
Yeah, so this is my fifth COP and almost every COP I come away feeling pretty concerned for our future. This is one of the first where I've really walked away feeling a little bit hopeful, and working on climate change loss and damage in particular, it's not the cheery end of climate policy, right? These are the things that are going to be lost and destroyed because of the adverse impacts of climate change. But one thing that surprised me this time was both the degree of consensus and prioritization that all of the developing countries had on kind of getting progress on loss and damage this year. And so we didn't see these divisions in the global south that we've often seen in recent COPs. And also there were kind of non-state actors or sub-state actors starting to become a lot more involved at the loss and damage end of climate policy. So for example, Nicola Sturgeon set up a new kind of climate justice fund focusing specifically on providing funding for loss and damage type projects. That's really interesting. I've never kind of seen anything like that before. And it balances this very kind of state-driven process, which COP is really all about.
Those are really interesting reflections from our experts. And I know we'll pick up some of that conversation as we chat today. Before we get into the weeds, Jared, can you give our audience a little bit of an insight about what are COPs good for? What is the purpose of this annual meeting to talk about climate change and respond to the climate crisis?
Well, I think there are a number of things that could be said here, and different people have different views. I think that one thing that's obviously important is that people talk, that when there's a problem, people talk about it and try to deliberate and find ways to make progress on it. And especially that's true in the case of global problems. It's important that countries speak to one another. And so that's one key piece of this, that countries are both negotiating and bargaining and trying to come up with some sort of solution. We know from social science literature on collective action, for example, things like repeated interactions, trust, monitoring of what other actors are doing, naming and shaming, having some sort of way of sanctioning or punishing actors that aren't participating. Of course, the UNFCCC is relatively weak on the last point, but overall, these are sorts of things that happen at COP in one way or another. And so these are sort of ingredients for collective action. And we can think about one thing that I often think about is the counterfactual. So if there weren't COPs, would we be in a better or worse place? I think there's an interesting debate there. But my sense overall is that COPs are a necessary component to addressing climate change, and they do move us in the right direction, albeit slowly.
You mentioned collective action, and Lisa, I want to come to you. I mean, by design, COP is this big multinational, multilateral effort to really go after climate change. I think recent times may have tested our faith in multilateralism. Should we have faith in the multilateral process around COP? Is this the right way to address this big global challenge?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I think Jared's points there are really kind of on topic and on point. And I suppose I would paraphrase Winston Churchill here saying that multilateralism might be the worst form of government, except for all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. And, you know, we see it's a slow process, an incremental process. It's COP is about consensus. Votes are not taken. This is about getting all 197 countries on board. And that's really difficult when you have countries like Saudi Arabia, you know, other oil producing countries that really stand to lose a lot and are there to protect their national interests. And that's their role. They're not the bad guys. They're doing what they're meant to be doing in this process. Same with China and India. And I think there's been a lot of kind of vilifying these countries in the press recently based on that discussion around kind of phase out and phase down, which we'll talk more about. I think things have kind of shifted in the last 5 years in multilateralism. And the Paris Agreement really is this innovative form of global governance. And so it's kind of, you know, we're trying it out, we're experimenting. There's a lot at stake in this experiment. But again, it's probably better than, you know, what's come before, because 12 years ago in Copenhagen, things really, really went wrong. And so this is kind of, you know, the best we've got at the moment.
You start us off, Lisa, by saying that you were hopeful coming out of this COP. You've been to many. What was it like? Can you give our listeners a little bit of a flavor of what it was like in Glasgow? And how did this compare to previous COPs that you've been to?
Yeah, so obviously this is the first COP since kind of COVID times. And that was very kind of, in some ways, you know, you were constantly kind of aware of that. So my whole team, we had to test every morning before we went to the venue. They had kind of maximum capacity issues. We had trouble getting in to watch the negotiations we wanted to watch because they were kind of capping numbers, whereas previously it has in a lot of ways been easier to kind of get access to the research that we wanted to do. So that was interesting. Having said that, we also waited in very long queues. I've never had to wait for kind of an hour in the queue to get into COP before, and there was a lot of criticism, of the UK government and the UNFCCC secretariat in terms of how things were set up. So I think that was one thing that felt quite different. The other thing that felt quite different was really the rhetoric at the start. There was very, very strong rhetoric. The first couple of days was devoted to the leader summit. So we heard kind of, Boris Johnson there talking for the first time about our kind of duty to poorer countries. Joe Biden, had similar rhetoric. I haven't heard that kind of thing coming from these leaders before. And of course, this is kind of Joe Biden's first COP. And, most of the COPs I've been to have been under a Trump presidency. It was the first COP I went to actually on the second morning there was when Trump won the election. And there was just kind of shock in the kind of COP venue in Marrakesh in 2016. So that felt different. Kind of different and hopeful. I think the third observation I would make is I went to see the Fridays for the Future march, and I saw the climate march on the Saturday. And it was really, really inspiring, kind of seeing the people on the streets and really having this understanding of like a lot of the solutions are not going to be lying in the COP venue. It's kind of coming from that the kind of power of the people who are becoming more and more engaged in this and pushing their leaders to do better. So that felt different to me as well.
That is fascinating. And I think from a kind of a, as political scientists, we sit here and we look and we think about, what is happening at the highest levels in government and from leadership, which, as you're saying, looks different and feels different this time. But that parallel activity that's going on from civil society, from the public who are really kind of out there marching alongside and demanding this change is also really interesting from a perspective of thinking about the politics of climate change. Let's get into some of the specifics around COP. When COP started, they articulated four goals: secure global net zero by mid-century and keep to 1.5 degrees. Second, to adapt to protect communities and natural habitats, to mobilize finance. And finally, to work together to deliver the Paris rulebook and accelerate action. So let's spend a little bit of time looking at two of those goals. Jared, could you give us a reminder about the Paris rulebook? What is it and why is it important?
Well, the Paris rulebook is essentially the rules for accounting for greenhouse gas emissions and reductions that countries will follow in order to show that that they've achieved their goals. Basically, countries are putting forward goals, of course, to reduce emissions, and there needs to be some way to understand the extent to which governments have actually met these goals. And that's what the Paris rulebook does. And it's actually very important. It's a bit of a technical piece of the negotiations, but it's very important because in a broader sense, what it does is it sets the rules for monitoring, essentially. So how governments, especially other states, can ensure that everyone is cooperating and contributing something. And that's a key piece of, going back to collective action, we know that's a key piece and that's crucial for sustaining collective action. So many of the details of the Paris rulebook had been agreed before COP26. Many of the kind of perhaps easier pieces of the negotiations had already been agreed. And the major outstanding issue for COP26 was on what's called Article 6 of the Paris Agreement, which is around carbon markets. And there, after 4 years of trying to get some agreement here, countries finally did reach a deal. And so what is Article 6 about? Well, it's about international cooperation in the context of mitigation. And that's specifically around the design of what are called carbon markets. And basically what carbon markets are markets for countries or also companies to buy and sell offsets or credits or emission reductions that go by a variety of names. And theoretically, what this is supposed to do is enable flexibility and especially cost effectiveness. And so, for example, if it's cheaper to reduce emissions in one country than it is in another, that country can reduce their emissions more and then sell those credits to a country where it's more costly to reduce emissions. There's also some ideas around co-benefits that when you sell emissions, you're then generating finance for a particular country, which can be invested in mitigation, et cetera. But of course, the danger here is that poorly designed rules could allow countries basically to meet their NDCs, their nationally determined contributions, without global emissions actually going down at all. And that's something that that was really important to prevent. And the key example here is double counting. And so double counting is, a jargony phrase, perhaps. But what it describes is a situation in which a country reduces its own emissions, sells those emissions to another country, which that second country can count towards its own goal. But the first country is also counting those emissions towards its goal. And so what you basically have are two countries counting the same emission reductions. And so if that was to happen, if that was to be allowed, all countries could just shift emissions around the globe. All countries meet their NDCs, but emissions actually don't go down. These are sort of the accounting loopholes.
And so how did COP address that? I mean, was there a resolution that now prevents that you can explain to the audience?
So COP did a number of things. So luckily, COP, there was some push. So Brazil, for example, wanted to allow double counting. There were some countries who wanted to allow this, which I think is just totally insane and an untenable position. And so a kind of sanity check was, could the agreement rule out double counting? And it does. And so double counting is not allowed under the Article 6 rules that were agreed. And there were two other kind of key pieces here. There are two types of markets that were set up by Article 6, and sort of rules were agreed in Glasgow. One was on project-based mitigation, where countries can invest or companies can invest in projects and sell those emission reductions abroad. But that's sort of less controversial because that also happened under Kyoto, and there is some architecture for some sort of knowledge of knowing how to do that. I think perhaps what is more concerning to me is a new idea where countries can sell whole blocks of emissions, and so that they can use towards their NDC. So again, if one country overachieves its NDC, it can sell those surplus emissions to a country that hasn't been able to achieve it. And there are a whole host of issues there and a whole sort of a number of potential possibilities for gaming the system, which I won't go into in detail. But the point is that there, while some loopholes, accounting loopholes, were closed at Glasgow, I think there's some that still remain open. And we'll see the extent to which governments try to exploit these accounting loopholes again, to hit their targets without actually reducing emissions.
That leads us firmly into a question I want to pose to you, Fergus, which is, you know, thinking about that goal around keeping 1.5 alive, you know, how well did the delegates do in terms of that commitment to net zero? What should we be proud of? Where was progress limited? What's your take on it?
Yeah, so I think so. One thing to just clarify at the beginning for our audience is that the targets that countries commit to are essentially not agreed at the COP. So under the Paris Agreement, these are, as Jared said, nationally determined contributions. And essentially, these targets are agreed and updated or not before the COP starts. And they're agreed through countries' domestic processes. Typically, they're approved by the executive branch, by cabinet or similar bodies. So we basically knew at the beginning of COP what countries' targets would be, and we could assess whether there was improvement or not. And we typically sort of look at these things in look at three indicators. So one is the long-term target. Another one is the 2030 target. And then there's the policies and measures that countries are actually putting in place to achieve their targets. Now, as Jared highlighted at the beginning, we did see some significant improvement in the number of countries making net zero targets, long-term targets, and that's good. So basically, 90% of the world's emissions are in jurisdictions that are now covered by a long-term net zero target. But the catch is sort of when you look at the details, as some expert analysts have done, and a lot of those targets suffer from sort of design flaws. So the quality of the targets is largely not very good. So, for example, the scope is not clear. They don't have a binding legal status. There's not a sort of transparency framework underpinning them, and so on. So there are still some concerns around net zero targets. Around on the 2030 targets, we're still, unfortunately, a very, very long way from where we need to be. So the targets that have submitted remain sort of vastly inadequate to achieve even 2-degree limit, let alone the 1.5-degree limit. And even more depressingly, that the policies that governments have committed or are undertaking don't even put us on track to meet the emissions reductions implicit in those 2030 targets. So there's a huge gap between what countries are doing and what they have said that they will ultimately do, what they've committed to doing. And these various gaps really need to be urgently closed.
I wanna talk about the kind of final days of COP. Quite a lot of the media coverage and the discussion around COP in those final negotiations and those final days was made about the fact that India had insisted on watering down language on phasing out coal. Why was it so hard for the countries to even talk about fossil fuels at COP, let alone do anything about them? Fergus.
Yeah, so the UNFCCC process operates by consensus, and that effectively means that every country has a veto over the outcome. And that, of course, includes large fossil fuel producing and or consuming countries. And they've used that veto power since the negotiations began to ensure that fossil fuels are kept off the agenda. And this is not just, you know, the Saudi Arabia and sort of Middle Eastern oil exporting countries. This is also Russia, Australia, the US, Canada, right? So this has been the norm. And this was only, as I mentioned at the beginning, only really just broken for the first time. But there's still obviously a lot of hesitancy from countries about kind of making these commitments to act to, you know, phase out even coal, let alone oil and gas. And so whilst this was inserted into the text, these measures to phase out coal and fossil fuel subsidies, they were progressively weakened by countries. They obviously didn't feel they could remove it entirely, that such as the change in the sort of negotiating atmosphere, but they weakened those commitments. So we talk about inefficient fossil fuel subsidies, and then countries that have fossil fuel subsidies just claim that theirs are efficient. We talk about accelerating efforts to phase down rather than phase out, and so on. And so we can see that this commitment has been weakened through the very same process that has kept fossil fuels off the agenda until COP26.
So, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, this kind of consensus and unanimity agreement, which binds the UN FCCC process, allows for veto players to kind of rule, you know, make exceptions around particular language. But are there other international efforts that are underway to tackle fossil fuels outside of this procedure?
Yeah, there are. And I think there are a lot of countries that want to and are moving faster on the key issue of fossil fuels. And, you know, let's be clear that whilst there are emissions, there are various sources of greenhouse gas emissions, fossil fuels are the overwhelming source. And so there are countries that want to move more quickly on that. So there are really efforts to tackle fossil fuels outside of the UNFCCC that are occurring on three fronts. So the first is that various countries are forming sort of clubs, kind of coalitions of the willing, if you like. So one example is the Powering Past Coal Alliance set up by the UK and Canadian governments a few years ago, which is about phasing out coal-fired power stations. At COP26, we saw the launch of the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance, which is about ending new licenses for oil and gas production and exploration and setting a date for their phase out. That's led by Denmark and Costa Rica. We also saw a lot of countries actually agreeing to, and some big countries agreeing to, end their financing of overseas fossil fuel projects. So these are some of the actions that countries are taking. The second front is there's a really big civil society push to develop a more comprehensive treaty, a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty modeled on its nuclear equivalent, the nuclear non-proliferation treaty. And in my own work, I've advocated for a system of fossil-free zones, which is also based on a nuclear precedent of nuclear weapon-free zones. And there's a lot of kind of civil society effort kind of pushing towards that. And then finally, the third front on which there's action in this regard is a lot of work by academics and policy experts that's trying to support these nascent initiatives, in particular sort of improving the informational basis on which they can act. And if I can just give two quick examples. So one is the Fossil Fuel Production Gap Report, which I've been involved in, and this monitors the gap between the fossil fuels that countries are planning to produce and compares that with the amount of fossil fuel production that would be consistent with 2-degree or 1.5-degree pathway. And that gap is also very, very large, right? So we need to reduce that. And that research has been happening every year for the last 3 years by leading research organizations and the UN Environment Program. And then the other example of sort of expert and academic work is that's being done is to produce a global registry of fossil fuels. So Jared talked earlier about the COP rulebook, which is about accounting for greenhouse gases. Well, if we're going to have this additional cooperation around fossil fuels, then we need to account for fossil fuels in some way. And so there are efforts to sort of develop an accounting system about that. And I actually have a paper that's just been accepted in Global Environmental Politics, which argues that such an accountability framework should focus on a combination of fossil fuel production volumes and fossil fuel infrastructure, rather than being based on fossil fuel reserves, which some people have suggested. So this is, I think, an interesting, vibrant, fast-moving space where there's a lot of activity.
Now, Lisa, one of the big issues, this kind of new third, let's say, paradigm around addressing climate change, we've been thinking about adaptation and mitigation. You have been leading a research project on loss and damage. Could you remind our listeners, what is loss and damage? How does this fit in to the wider set of considerations and responses to climate change? And what was agreed in Glasgow around loss and damage?
Yeah, right. So I think you've articulated it really nicely. We think of it maybe as a third pillar of climate policy. And so we know that climate change is going to have adverse impacts, right? Weather-related impacts. And the losses and damages that flow from those impacts are starting to get a lot more attention within the UNFCCC. It was first kind of institutionalized in 2013 at the Warsaw COP. And since then, there's been, it's been kind of quite a contentious area of the negotiations. But what we mean when we talk about loss and damage are, for example, economic losses. So if you have a hurricane or a cyclone or flooding, and you have roads that are washed away, homes that are washed away, infrastructure that is destroyed, that counts as loss and damage. We might also think about what are called non-economic losses. So thinking about kind of detrimental impacts on health or loss of culture, ways in which human rights are undermined through the impacts of climate change is also a part of that. And work on climate change related displacement also falls within this category as an area of governance within the UNFCCC. So there are different forms of mobility and they act different, they interact differently with climate change, but really that kind of the more forced end of the spectrum when we think about human mobility. So people who have to kind of leave in a hurry because of extreme weather events. You might also talk about planned relocation. So in Fiji, there's kind of a program of moving communities whose whose land is disappearing because of coastal erosion, because of sea level rise, that can also be kind of fall under that category of loss and damage. So it's a whole kind of range of different issues. And it matters because, if we think about that difference between reaching a 1.5 degree increase versus a 2 degree increase, there's quite stark differences in terms of the forms and kind of breadth of loss and damages that we're going to experience. So that 1.5 degree, this phrase we keep using, 1.5 to stay alive, for certain small island developing states in the Pacific, I'm thinking about Kiribati, I'm thinking about Tuvalu, Samoa, for example, the Marshall Islands, those countries are quite likely to lose, a large portion, if not all of their territory. And that's what we mean by keeping that alive. And so that really is starting to fall into that loss and damage kind of basket of policymaking. In terms of what was agreed on loss and damage at Glasgow, maybe it's worth thinking about what was kind of pushed for by developing countries, who are the ones who've been really leading the charge on this. And developed countries have been fairly resistant on kind of moving this area of policymaking within this regime forward. But developing countries were asking for kind of new and additional finance to start to really address loss and damage. So a lot of these countries are already experiencing the impacts of climate change in the form of extreme weather events and in the form of slow onset impact. So also talking about kind of glacial retreat, the kind of drought, increasing, kind of land degradation and kind of expanding deserts. So what they were asking for was more money, basically. And they didn't get it at Glasgow is the upshot. What they got instead was a dialogue about more money. And so that's meant to happen over the next year. I'm a little bit skeptical. At the 2017 COP, we also got a SUVA expert, what was called the SUVA expert dialogue on finance, on loss and damage. So to me, this feels a little bit like deja vu. There are members of my team and people I spoke to in civil society who feel a little bit more hopeful than I do, that actually there is some real potential between now and the next COP in Egypt in a year's time to make the most of that opportunity and really start to think about what does a kind of finance facility on loss and damage look like. But that has been the kind of ask from developing countries for the best part of a decade now. So it's a slow moving process.
Thanks, Lisa. Jared, I want to round out kind of our deep dive on a few questions, thinking about domestic politics and COP and how they intersect, particularly in large polluting countries like the US and the UK. Both Boris Johnson and Joe Biden struck upbeat and optimistic tones, but will the US and the UK deliver on their commitments?
Yeah, this is a very important question, and a question that I really focus on in my research. I think in terms of how COP intersects with domestic politics, there are a few pieces to this. And so some are quite perhaps mundane. I mean, one is routinized decision making. I think one thing that COP does is it puts a date on the calendar of every government where they have to come and talk to other governments and bring something to the table and talk about climate change. And it's sort of the structure to climate policy making. Whether countries actually do that or not is a different story, but at least there is a kind of structured routine now for climate policy making. And I think it's getting more embedded as we move deeper into sort of operationalizing the Paris Agreement. I think perhaps, maybe one of the most important things that COP does, especially recently, is it really increases the salience of climate change amongst domestic audiences. And we can see this, especially from media reports around COP. And so, especially here in the UK, given that the UK was the host country, a ton of media attention was devoted to the COP. But I also saw a lot of articles in the US, Canada, and also in European newspapers. And what it does by increasing the salience is that it gets it on sort of the minds of average citizens and average voters, and they can start to agitate for change. I mean, we know that, of course, in democracies, politicians pay close attention to voter preferences. And if climate change rises up the policy agenda for voters, if it's seen as a very important issue to voters, Hopefully, politicians will also start to see it that way. And there is some evidence of this in the social science literature, which I won't go into, but there's some evidence that around COPs, especially, governments adopt more policies, especially in the host countries, again, in an effort to kind of show the world that they're doing something. I think one other thing that COP does, and to sort of drive domestic politics, it sort of gives a sense of other countries and other countries' publics, gives them an idea of what the other big polluters are doing. And so, for example, it gets major polluters like the US or China or Russia to come, or India, to come to the world stage and tell everyone what their plans are for reducing emissions. And I think citizens pick up on that, and the extent to which they see other countries, especially the big countries, taking effort on climate change, it may shape, and again, there's some evidence of this, it may shape their preferences to get their countries to do more. Lastly, on whether the UK or the US can deliver on their commitments. The UK already has quite an impressive architecture for addressing climate change, a legal architecture under the Climate Change Act of 2008. And so in a way, I'm a bit more optimistic. I mean, Boris Johnson and the UK government will be able to reach its long-term goals. Although we know from the progress report from the Climate Change Committee in the UK, which is the independent monitor of UK climate policy, we know that the government's off track. And we know also in the most recent budget from the Treasury that certain key climate policies aren't or weren't included in that. For example, increasing taxes on some carbon sources. But all that said, the UK at least has, when we compare it to the US, the UK at least has some architecture, some existing policies. The US is a totally different story. At the federal level, the US basically has no climate policy after the Trump administration has reversed all of it, virtually. And we know now, as we speak, the Biden administration and Senate Democrats are trying to strike a deal with the Build Back Better plan, which includes essentially subsidies for renewable energy and electric vehicles. If that passes, those would be the most significant domestic policies the U.S. has ever adopted, though the jury is still out. I mean, the jury is very much still out on whether the Democrats can strike a deal on it. I think it could go either way. It won't be the first time that the U.S. fails to adopt bold action.
That takes us very nicely to my last question, kind of quick fire to each of you. I mean, we're already 2 weeks post Glasgow, the countdown is on to Sharm el Sheikh. But what happens now? What do we need to do to kind of take forward the motivations and the agreements from Glasgow and really put those into effect over the next year, so that by the time we get to Sharm el Sheikh, we are starting from a different position? Jared?
I think there are a number of things. I think perhaps the most important, especially in democratic countries, is the continued pressure of citizens and NGOs and social movements, putting continued pressure on governments to act, and keeping the salience of the issue high. Governments right now are facing a range of different issues they need to respond to. And for example, the pandemic, economic recovery, inflation is creeping up in some countries, energy prices. But keeping climate change on the top of the agenda, I think, is important to make sure governments actually deliver.
Fergus, your thoughts?
Yeah, so I mean, I think, you know, the COPs will always be there. That process is going to continue, and that's important, and it should continue. But, you know, as I've said, it's a lowest common denominator institution. And so I think what's really important is that we need to be pushing on other fronts, both domestically, as Jared said, but also internationally. And so what we need to see is governments being willing to kind of join these clubs that I've mentioned around fossil fuels and to start new ones, for example, on, you know, getting more cooperation to sort of roll out, low carbon energy sources and so on. And then using their diplomatic levers to put pressure on more reluctant countries to join those groups. And one thing I'd really like to see a renewed focus on in particular is the idea of no new fossil fuel infrastructure and projects. And so I think that's going to be a key priority for a lot of people in the coming years.
And Lisa, final word to you.
Yeah, that's great. And I'm thinking really about the kind of four of us that are sitting here. And for me, there's a real research agenda that's been laid by COP26 and really interesting questions about how to pull in new actors and new energy into this particular space. So Fergus and I, for example, are doing some work with the Equality and Human Rights Commission, who are thinking about climate change and its intersections with human rights. And really excitingly, we're launching our new climate politics cluster in the department. And so really looking forward to kind of working with a range of colleagues, both within the department and across UCL and beyond, to really kind of think about what kind of, you know, good, rigorous and critical research is needed to feed into the processes that are going to take us from COP26 to COP27 over the next year.
It's been a delight to speak to all three of you. Thank you very much, Jared Finnegan, Fergus Green, and Lisa Van Halle, for joining me today. Please do check out the Department of Political Sciences Climate and Environment Experts on our departmental website and those across social and historical sciences and UCL to hear the latest analysis and insight. We'll provide links to all of these in the show's episode's notes. Next week, we're talking to Kristen Baca and Kit Rickard on their recent paper examining the persistence of paramilitary groups' informal justice systems in the form of so-called punishment attacks in Northern Ireland. As ever, make sure you don't miss out on further episodes of UCL Uncovering Politics. All you need to do is subscribe. You can do so on Apple, Spotify, or whatever podcast provider you use. I'm Jennifer Hudson. Our producer is Abby Turner. Our theme music is written and performed by John Mann. This has been UCL Uncovering Politics. Thank you very much for listening.